Welcome to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Aaron Zellin, founder of Jihadology.net.
And I'm Carl Morand, the show's producer. This episode features an interview with North Caucasus Caucus, an analyst on jihadism in Turkey, Azerbaijan, and the Caucasus.
We talked about his recent trip to Turkey, the evolution in Turkish governmental policy towards jihadis, Turks' role in jihadi groups and IS in Syria and Turkey, Turkey's recent arrest campaign against Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State, and the response from both groups to the...
And stay tuned after the interview when we'll have an updated hashtag social media segment covering jihadi social media postings over the past couple weeks.
So today on the show we have North Caucasus Caucus. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Today we're going to be talking a little bit about Turkey and the Islamic State and Turkish citizens related to the Islamic State and everything going on in Syria as well. So you have recently been to Turkey and so probably have maybe some more unique insights than just, you know, when you're following it online. So I wanted to start off with sort of looking at Turkish policy regarding jihadis and the Islamic State in general. Of course, it's been a controversial issue in some ways since, you know, when you talk to a lot of Turkish officials, many times, at least in terms of the foreign fighter issue, they blame it on the Europeans since the Europeans are not stopping them to come to their territory. And therefore deflecting any, you know, responsibility. But we have seen now, at least in some ways, that they've started to take the issue a bit more seriously in terms of border security, in terms of arresting individuals, not just Islamic State guys, but also even Jabhat al-Nusra sympathizers. So I was wondering if you could briefly talk a little bit about this evolution and where we are now and sort of whether you think the Turkish state is truly putting its full power behind what's going on.
Sure. So I had worked in Turkey in 2011. And when I returned to the U.S. at the beginning of 2012, you know, I started following Syria a lot. And I mean, through 2012, 2013, you know, I had this similar view of a lot of people. Oh, you know, the Turkish state's not doing enough. They need to be doing more. They're allowing people, blah, blah, blah. But then in April of last year, of 2014, I decided, okay, I'm going to go check out the situation myself. And just arriving at the airport, it kind of changed my whole view on it in the sense that, okay, there's a lot. It's a lot more complicated than people are making it out to be. A lot of the issues were also a confluence of events from just years of changes in Turkish economics and foreign policy, in the sense that Turkey had, in terms of diplomacy, had changed visa regimes to allow a lot more people from North Africa, especially, to travel easily to Turkey. They'd also had a great deal of diplomacy through Turkish Airlines in that they opened up all these flights. So when you arrive at the airport, at least in April of 2014, you're in a line, an hour-long line, with people from about 30, 40 different countries, and eight guys having to go through all of them. And you realize this is an enormous, enormous task. And then in the sense of getting to border areas, I mean, I just went to the bus station, gave them the cash, got the tickets, and didn't have to show ID. But that's actually different. When I was there most recently, they actually did ask for a passport in order to buy bus tickets. But, I mean, Turkey is a relatively open country. I mean, that's changing a lot more now with the current conflict. But at least last year, you know, there's not checkpoints all around the country stopping buses and, you know, checking people's identifications. Though there is some of that in, I mean, even prior to the most recent fighting in southeastern areas that had happened. I had been on buses where, you know, just randomly stopped on the side of the street and, you know, soldiers came on and checked everyone's IDs. But in the sense of getting down there were so many different ways. You could have got off in Adana and got on a dolmuş down to Rahanle. You could have continued to go, gotten to Gaziantep, and just, you know, there's every single hour there's many buses running to Kilis. So, I mean, that was the situation last year. And it was a much bigger issue than I think a lot of people gave the Turks credit for, in the sense that people were giving the Turkish government a really hard time about it. And I think that a lot of that was a little bit unfair. But this year, there's definitely been some serious actions against the Islamic State in Turkey. Actually, I was talking to Aaron Stein earlier today about this, and we were kind of come to an agreement that the first major stuff started happening in actually March of this year. That's when they started actually getting pretty tough on the border, and also around, let's see, and March is when they had a series of arrests in Sakarya and Malatya, which are in kind of central southern Turkey. And after that, you know, you saw a lot more action. I actually think that one of the major issues was there was a kind of divide between the political, I mean, the same thing you see in a lot of countries. There's a divide on the what the threat was between politicians and security forces and intelligence officials within Turkey. I think that from, you know, what's available in the open source, that Turkish security officials definitely saw the Islamic State as a threat, but they were a bit hesitant to do things or didn't have the, you know, the, okay, go out and do it, which, you know, constrained them a little bit. But I mean, I think that they're identifying people for a long time. They're watching people. So then when we saw the arrests in the beginning of July, it was the people you'd exactly expect to be arrested were arrested immediately. I mean, because they had been identified well before that. I mean, within that, I think you also had the issue of back in December of 2013, you had these major reorganizations and people getting moved around in the Turkish National Police Force. And I think that that had a major impact on some of the stuff we're seeing now. So you had mentioned that there had also been arrests of Jabhat al-Nusra members or supporters of al-Qaeda in Turkey. I actually think that that is a result of Turkish police, national police, not necessarily being able to tell the difference between ISIS supporters and Jabhat al-Nusra supporters. There had been a lot of people who were involved in counterterrorism in the Turkish National Police who were reassigned or left the police due to the whole purges, the Gulenist purges that had happened all throughout the last year and that continue to this day.
So moving to the activities of Turkish involvement in terms of individuals, not the state, inside of Turkey and Syria in these jihadi networks, I was wondering if you could get a little bit into this. Obviously, you've also looked into, in the past year or so, historical networks in terms of people going abroad to fight. But I was wondering, how related are some of these historical networks, especially since many people last decade to get to Iraq went through Turkey and then Syria to get there, or whether a lot of what we're seeing now is a lot of new faces getting involved in what's been going on?
At least in terms of the Islamic State, it appears to be a lot of new people. That's the interesting kind of divide that at least I have seen from looking at the biographies of various fighters that have been with Jabhat al-Nusra or with ISIS. The guys involved with ISIS definitely appear to be newer and more recently involved in jihadist activity. The guys with Jabhat al-Nusra are the ones that appear to have the more historical connections to these pro-Al-Qaeda networks that had existed in Turkey for years. I mean, the most famous one is Mehmet Akinci, whose brother was involved in the 2003 HSBC bombings. But there's been a number of other cases as well. For example, I was just looking at this yesterday. Ümit Toprak, who was the famous Yusuf al-Turki, the wolf group or wolf brigade sniper trainer who was killed in the airstrikes in September of 2014, he had been involved in Afghanistan in 2009 through 2012. I mean, according to biographies put out about him. But before that, he had actually been arrested in 2004, allegedly as part of this plot in Bursa, like this cell in Bursa connected to Ansar Islam, which was planning to try to assassinate George W. Bush when he was at the NATO conference in Istanbul. But it was broken up. And actually, Ümit Toprak's older brother, I believe his name is Alparslan Toprak, was identified as the leader and sentenced to 12 years in jail. He's actually out of jail now, and actually spoke to the media and led prayers in September in honor of his brother when his brother was killed in the airstrikes. And one thing that was kind of interesting is he said, my brother was on the top of the ISIS hit list, and now look what happened. The U.S. took him out. I thought that was kind of interesting. So you see that a lot. For example, in May, there were other airstrikes, and that's when I'd had the view before that after the fitna, that there were not nearly as many Turks in Jabhat al-Nusra, that most of them had gone along with ISIS. But in these airstrikes in May of this year, there was, I think, there was varying figures, but at least 10, maybe as many as 15 Turks. I have the biographies of 10, but there was reports of 15 were killed outside of Aleppo, Idlib. And a lot of these guys had previously been in Afghanistan. And there's definitely a lot more of those sort of connections you see there. So, I mean, it's relatively clear, and it's actually quite similar to the previous cases. So, for example, the guys who all fought in the Ogaden, I'd written an article for your website about this last summer on Turks who fought in Ogaden against the Ethiopians. They had all previously been involved in Bosnia, and I think that they were connected with a AQ recruiter facilitator figure, or at least one of them was connected in Bosnia, and he became kind of the leader for this group that ended up going to the Ogaden. So I think you're seeing relatively similar things now. And also, I mean, from what's available, one of the big differences between Jabhat al-Nusra fighters and ISIS fighters is you hear of, you know, dozens and dozens of families who reported to the Turkish government, oh, you know, my son, he's disappeared. You have to help me. But you don't really hear that with Jabhat al-Nusra. Actually, pro-Jabhat al-Nusra websites put out testimonials with the families of Turkish Jabhat al-Nusra fighters who were killed, where they basically said, you know, this was my son's choice. He's defending Islam, all that sort of thing, saying that they were sad, but they agreed with their decision. I think one thing that's quite interesting as well is I don't think that a lot of Turks know that Jabhat al-Nusra is actually connected to al-Qaeda. I talked to one researcher who had interviewed a Turkish member of Ahrar al-Sham. Just real quick, though, there had been an article last week that said that Ahrar al-Sham had the most Turkish fighters of any group, but that's completely unsubstantiated. I've only seen a handful of Turkish fighters in Ahrar al-Sham ever, so I hope that claim doesn't end up getting repeated. It was in today's Zaman. But anyways, this Turkish member of Ahrar al-Sham, he originally went as part of an aid convoy from Fatih, and when they got to Syria, they were distributing aid and everything like that. He kind of just said, okay, guys, see you later, and left, and made his way, eventually was accepted and joined Ahrar al-Sham. But he fought with them for about a year. But when this researcher was interviewing him, they were talking about Jabhat al-Nusra. And he said, you know, Jabhat al-Nusra is connected to al-Qaeda. And he says, wait, what? Connected to al-Qaeda? I had no idea. And this guy had, you know, fought alongside of them and had no idea. So I think that actually is, like in other places, Jabhat al-Nusra has a lot more prestige associated with it because, yeah, they're fighting the regime. People don't know that they're connected to al-Qaeda. And even if they do know that, it's not necessarily as dirty of a thing as ISIS.
It's interesting, especially since Jabhat al-Nusra's flag says al-Qaeda and Bilal al-Sham on it. So Obviously, we know that the Turks are heavily involved in sort of the facilitation and logistics of individuals coming from the outside in to get into Syria and then smuggled across the border. But what kind of activities are Turkish fighters doing with the Islamic State or Jebel Tunusra or any other smaller jihadi faction? Do you see them mainly as foot soldiers, commanders? Are any of them in senior level leadership? Do you see them involved in sort of at least the Islamic State side of things with the state building apparatus versus the fighting? Could you get into that a little bit, maybe?
Sure. In terms of the Islamic State, I have not really seen any Turks who had risen to a very high level. I mean, a lot of them were involved in major battles, but I never saw major commanders who were Turkish. The last major commander that I saw who was Turkish was Ahmet Kunduz, a guy from Kayseri, who was actually killed at the beginning of 2014, but he was considered the Islamic State commander for like the Turkish group. But he was the last one I saw that was like a major kind of field commander type. But other than that, we saw Turks as fighters, suicide bombers. And recently we've seen them more involved in the propaganda side, in the official propaganda side, with the launch of a bunch of different initiatives in this past 6 months involving Turkish language ISIS propaganda. For example, in March, they registered Darul Khalifa, which eventually became clear was the part of the Al Hayat, like an official Al Hayat website. And just this morning, I was doing some research. I found in April, they had released a pretty well done, you know, Darul Khalifa is coming kind of trailer. But that initiative has basically been shut down in terms of the Twitter feed still exists, but the website has been shut down. Also, along with the website, they also started doing the daily news bulletins in releasing both the audio and text every day. The audio doesn't come out every single day, but it comes out pretty regularly. And they also started releasing they've released two issues of Constantinia, which is a specifically Turkish magazine. But I mean, I think that this is all part of a broader trend that you've seen, because also this year you've seen a lot more official Russian language stuff, but you've also seen more official Balkan languages, specifically Bosnian. The website, I'm going to butcher the name of this. Actually, I'm not even going to try to go with the Bosnian. it's called, let's see, I believe the Saber of Paradise. The Saber of Truth, Sibilia Istinia. That is kind of like the Darul Khalifa for Bosnian language. I'm not sure if it's 100% connected. It's not like the Bosnian language desk for Al Hayat. I'm not sure about that. But it does release basically simultaneously all the videos and all the releases in Bosnian at a very high quality. So, I mean, they identified themselves as such, but you know, I don't have confirmation on that. On the other side, on the Jebel Tunusra side, you saw Turks in more senior sorts of roles. I mean, the most prominent one is the one I already mentioned, Yusuf al-Turki Ümit Toprak, who was the head of the Wolf Brigade, and who was a sniper commander. But since he's been killed, nobody super prominent has emerged since then. But that's also a factor of some of the Jebel Tunusra pro al-Qaeda propaganda also being censored. On one side, that has been cracked down on. For example, the website Ümit Islam, which is run by this guy, Muhammad Isra, who kind of acted as an embedded Turkish journalist with Jebel Tunusra. He went to Idlib and he interviewed Sharis from Jebel Tunusra with specific messages to Turks and Turkish people, which were subtitled, as well as he put out a 5-part series on kind of the legacy of Ümit Toprak, looking at Turkish snipers and other Jabhat al-Nusra snipers who had been trained by him and kind of what they were doing, and they're fighting around Idlib. But he was at the front lines with them and also in their areas where they were putting things, where they were putting together their equipment.
So moving to the recent arrest campaign over the past month or so, or I guess now maybe 2 months almost, you've been collecting a lot of interesting information and data on it. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about all of the arrests that Turkey's been making of Turkish IS, JN, and other type of individuals. What has this meant for the organizations? Sort of what's the regional distribution? And how have you seen this playing out in terms of whether this is really change the dynamics on the ground?
Sure. So I've been collecting this data with Aaron Stein and Noah Blazer for the past 2 months now, since basically the middle of July. Before the crackdown really began in the beginning of July, we saw a bunch of arrests, approximately 50-ish, between July 1st and July 13th, that was focusing on Istanbul, Ankara, Gaziantep, though the Gaziantep was majority foreigners, Konya, Adana. And these arrests, they targeted some figures you would absolutely expect to be targeted. For example, the guy who was running the website Enfal Media, which was had been around since 2010, but originally started out as a pro Islamic State in Iraq website, but quickly morphed into a pro ISIS website. And for a long time, that and its kind of sister site, Takva Haber, acted as the Turkish language ISIS propaganda hub. They reported on lots and lots of different stuff, but they always reported very positively on ISIS and always highlighted their videos. They weren't releasing them with subtitles, but they were, every time a video came out, they were saying, okay, this is what this video is about. Here's the links to it, blah, blah, blah. So after Suruç, the bombing in Suruç on July 23rd, you saw a major uptick in the numbers of detentions. That's a major point, that there's the numbers between the detentions and the arrests are a lot different. Since then, there's been more than 100 detentions, and a lot of that has been focused in similar places in Istanbul and the neighboring province of Kocaeli and Gebze, Yalova, as well as down in Adana, Mersin area, and recently more, I believe, between August 11th and now, there's been around 65-ish detentions in the border areas south of Gaziantep, but almost all of those were foreigners. I think there's only two or three Turks who were probably most likely smugglers who were arrested. So we had calculated approximately, of those 200-plus detentions, we had calculated approximately 70-ish arrests, though most recently there hasn't been that much information coming out in terms of how many arrests there were. But there was a report just a couple days ago, a HDP, Kurdish political party, one of their members was able to get the official figures for the number of ISIS members held that were formally arrested and held in jail. And the number that they had was 126. And that data was from the 18th of August, the 10th of August, excuse me. But I think a lot of those arrests were not actually during this July-August crackdown, but I think a lot of them actually were ISIS members who were arrested after Tel Abyad. A lot of ISIS fighters turned themselves in. Because I remember at that time, the Turkish government was saying, oh, we've detained approximately 500 fighters. And that number had seemed huge at the time. And I believe that a lot of them were fighters who had just turned themselves in after the fall of Talibiyat to the YPG. One thing that's quite interesting is there's been basically zero arrests in the southeast, though there have been a lot of fighters from those areas. For example, Diyarbakir, Bingöl, there's been zero arrests, even though those have been areas that have been highlighted. And even though there's been detentions in places like Adıyaman, which has been highlighted a number of times in the media and by local politicians as being a major ISIS recruitment hub, everyone who was detained there, which detention was on the 24th of July, 10 people were detained. All of them were released. None of them were formally arrested. The same thing with Hacı Bayram in the neighborhood in Ankara, which is well known as being a major recruitment center, the one that had been highlighted by the New York Times and a number of different Turkish news outlets. And it was the home neighborhood of one of the most famous Turkish ISIS recruiters / facilitators. There's Ozhan Gözlemecioğlu. So, but everyone also detained in those operations in Hacı Bayram were also released. So the arrests have been mainly focused in Istanbul, Konya, a couple in Ankara, Tarsus, and Manisa. So, I mean, it looks like the rate of detentions and arrests have both slowed down in the past couple weeks. The ones in most recently were all along the border, all foreigners.
So do you think that this has affected the flow of foreign fighters, or do you think that people are still coming in a steady stream, or it's been a deterrent maybe?
I don't know if it's been a deterrent. I think it has become much harder. I mean, that might just also be the fact that people don't have good information. I mean, they're not compiling a map of detentions and arrests. Sure. Yes. So I think that, you know, people still think that it's not that hard, because it still is easy for, especially if you're somebody who has never had any sort of connection to terrorism or anything like that before, it's not that hard from a lot of countries just to get on an airplane and get to Turkey.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a huge tourist destination.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I think that they are clamping down quite a bit on the border areas, especially areas near ISIS-controlled territories. I think that it's actually been quite difficult. I mean, we've seen a couple references by there was one British ISIS fighter who had tweeted, like, you know, brothers, it's become much more difficult. Be careful if you're trying to come. Like, there's still ways to come, but definitely only go with someone trusted. Don't
go with somebody random. I saw that thing too. So
yeah, so I think that there's definitely a lot harder to get to the ISIS-controlled territories through Turkey.
Yeah, so one of the interesting things we've seen too, since a lot of these arrests have occurred over the last 6 to 8 weeks or so, is that it appears, I mean, you probably would know this better than me, that there's been more official media content directed at Turkey. Obviously, there's the Constantine magazine, but also there have been some video messages in Turkish as well. So could you describe a little bit how the Islamic State has sort of responded to what's been going on in relation to the Turkish state?
Sure. I mean, honestly, outside of videos, and I've seen some Turkish fighters threatening the Turkish government and the U.S. online, I mean, there hasn't been a whole lot of activity against the Turkish government inside of Turkey. That's not to say that nothing will happen, but I think that the Turkish security services are strong enough to break up a lot of the potential threats. For example, they have uncovered caches of suicide vests inside of Turkey. But I think that I think that the security services, in some cases, have been following people for a long time and knew who to arrest, knew who the major figures were. And if they weren't arresting them, they are continuing to watch them. There hasn't been a whole bunch, honestly. But there has been a lot of other interesting kind of blowback from the Turkish involvement in the coalition. One thing that was quite interesting recently was there was an airstrike in Azaz, in northern Syria, in which reportedly a number of children were killed. And this became a pretty big event online, even for pro-government figures, Islamist journalists, prominent, you know, pro-occupy commentators were very, very upset about this, because the initial report was that the planes had taken off from Incirlik, and they're basically saying, well, now this is our doing as well. We share the blame for the deaths caused by the U.S. So I don't know if that sort of thing will have a major effect, but the more Turkey becomes involved, the more they're going to have to kind of share the blame. Because, I mean, even people who don't like ISIS, for example, like pro-AQ figures, there's a couple of them who have been arrested. Miraj Kara Aslan, who is a pro-AQ, pro-Jabhat al-Nusra reporter, a guy named Osman Akyıldız, who ran or who runs Kürsel Kitap Publications, which is a book publisher which produces pro-Al-Qaeda. You know, they produce translations of books by Zawahiri and Kutub and all these, you know, various well-known jihadi figures, as well as original stuff by Turkish authors about jihadism in general. But he was arrested, as well as several other imams, Kubeli Kurt, Musa Hoca, who are definitely anti-ISIS figures. And these figures, for example, Miraj Kara Aslan released a pretty scathing article after he got arrested saying, you know, I have written so much against ISIS. There was actually a, like, ISIS Twitter hashtag against him, calling him, like, a liar and everything like that. But he, in his article, he said, you know, I've written so much against it, and the Turkish state can't even tell the difference between me and them. Like, what is going on in this situation? So I think that they have a small chance of producing some anger towards the government by figures who not necessarily would have had anger originally. But on the other hand, they, even though they hate ISIS, they still dislike the U.S. more. So even actions against ISIS launched from Turkey, I think they're still going to be opposed to them.
So just to sort of wrap things up in some ways, where do you think the trajectories are going for everything that's going on from the perspective of the Turkish state, but also in terms of the Islamic State or Jabhat al-Nusra in relation to Turkey? We've obviously seen, you know, this policy of this anti-IS zone, even though I personally see it as more a way for the Turkish state to block the Kurds from linking up their different cantons. Obviously, so far, it doesn't seem like it's really changed much. And the Islamic State's actually taken over areas in northern Aleppo now for the first time since January, February 2014. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about sort of the trajectories of where you're going, what the debate is in sort of Ankara right now, as well as sort of the Islamic State's perspective on this in terms of what they might attempt to do vis-a-vis Turkey if they really do amp things up.
Sure. I mean, I think that the biggest threat, at least from the Islamic State, is is the possibility of attacks inside of Turkey. I mean, that's always been the threat, but I mean, a relatively small attack would have a relatively big impact at this point, because already with the, you know, renewal of violence between the Turkish state and the PKK, it's been hurting tourism, it's been hurting a lot of things. But if there was a even just lone wolf attack in Turkey by ISIS, even if it was undirected by the ISIS leadership, it would have a significant impact on the Turkish tourist economy, which is huge. For example, there had been some talk about a similar attack in areas like Antalya in southern Turkey, similar to what happened in Tunisia, which would not be that difficult. I mean, one thing which I can't really, it's something I've been kind of looking at, but haven't been able to quantify it at all, is the increase in the amount of, like, gun violence that's been happening in Turkey. You've been seeing a lot more shootings, even just completely non-political events. But I think part of this might be due to the fact that there's just so many more weapons now inside of Turkey than there had been previously. Just all sorts of stuff that had just come over the border, not necessarily even for the purposes of terrorist attacks, but just, you know, weapons are everywhere now. So I think that overall, Turkey is going to be able to handle the ISIS threat pretty well. I mean, the Turkish security services are pretty good. They have been keeping an eye on ISIS figures inside of Turkey for a long time. I think that they'll probably be able to break up most major attacks inside of Turkey.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on to the podcast. Really appreciate it. I'm sure the listeners will enjoy the granularity of a lot of the information you've talked about today. So thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
This episode's hashtag social media segment will cover postings from August 17th through the 31st.
During that time span, two foreign fighters were killed in Libya. One was from Sudan and the other was from Senegal. Also during that time period, 16 foreign fighters were killed in Iraq fighting with the Islamic State.
And during that time, 8 foreign fighters were killed in Syria with various groups. And 24 military operations were conducted by al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen.
On August 17th, Wilayat Nineveh of the Islamic State shows off its cattle breeding farm.
Also on the 17th, Ansar al-Sharia in Libya's education office showed off children taking their final exams in Benghazi, Libya.
On the 17th as well, Wilayat al-Jazeera of the Islamic State shows off its primary healthcare center in the town of al-Mahlabiya, Iraq.
On August 19th, Wilayat Hama of the Islamic State shows off its tractor repair workshop.
On the 19th as well, Wilayat Al Jazeera of the Islamic State shows off the electronic weighing system for trucks on the highway in the village of Tal Abta, Iraq.
Also on the 19th, Wilayat Dijla of the Islamic State shows off the second round of final exams.
On August 19th, the Islamic State releases an app on the Android store for Russian language primary source releases.
On August the 22nd, Wilayat al-Farat of the Islamic State shows off the second round of final exams in Rawa, Iraq.
On the 22nd as well, Wilayat al-Farat of the Islamic State shows off the tile industry in Abu Kamal, Syria.
On August 24th, Wilayat Nineveh of the Islamic State's Diwan al-Khidmat opens a new road in the area of Amalia.
On August 24th, Wilayat al-Fallujah of the Islamic State cleans up and restores the children's hospital after an airstrike by coalition or Iraqi government forces.
Also on the 24th, Wilayat al-Raqqa of the Islamic State's inspection office of its Diwan al-Hizbah places its seal on Okayd shops in al-Raqqa City, Syria.
On August 25th, Wilayat al-Dijla of the Islamic State lays new water pipes in al-Kayara district in Iraq.
Also on the 25th, Wilayat Damashq of the Islamic State creates a medical point in the western Al-Qalamun district.
On August 26th, Wilayat al-Barqa of the Islamic State receives repentances from so-called apostates in Hal in al-Harawa, Libya.
Also on the 26th, Wilayat Homs of the Islamic State graduates a new class from its Lion's Den military training camp.
On August 28th, Wilayat Sinai of the Islamic State distributes food to ordinary Muslims.
On August 30th, Wilayat al-Farat of the Islamic State shows off the salt mines in al-Qa'amin, Iraq.
Also on the 30th, Wilayat al-Farat of the Islamic State graduates a new class from its Saif al-Bahr military training camp.
If you have any feedback, you can email podcast@jihadology.net or find us on Twitter where we are @jihadpod. If you're a fan of the show, please consider taking a moment to rate and review it in iTunes, which will help more people find the program. Also, we have a special series that we're working on the state of jihadi studies, and we need some help transcribing interviews for that program. The series will feature interviews with numerous scholars in the field of jihadi studies, and if you'd like to help us out by transcribing some of the interviews, you can send us an email, podcast@jihadology.net, and we'll be in touch.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks to the North Caucasus Caucus for coming onto the show and sharing his expertise with us. Also, thanks to the podmaster, Carl Moran, for making sure this podcast sounds and runs smoothly. Until next time, I'm out.